Good evening and welcome to this extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for August 25th, 2023. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, we'll hear from the University of Idaho's Malcolm N. Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium this week on generative artificial intelligence text applications and how they will impact academics and the classroom. Also, North Idaho College hires new attorney with ties to right-wing extremists, and the West Bonner School District bypasses its own legal counsel and sends its new anti-trans policy to far-right anti-gay advocacy group in Arizona for legal review. Also, a manslaughter conviction in Lewiston. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Caroline Malone. Tropical storm Hillary has shattered rainfall records in parts of the United States, leaving heavy flooding in Southern California. It's the first tropical storm to hit the Los Angeles area in more than 80 years. Ira Spitzer reports.
About 20,000 Southern California residents were still without power Monday morning as officials continue to assess the damage from tropical storm Hillary. The storm, which began as a Category 4 hurricane in the Pacific, has been downgraded to a tropical depression as it moves through the state of Nevada. Hillary brought record levels of rainfall to cities like San Diego and Los Angeles, both of which closed schools on Monday. It's very rare for hurricanes and tropical storms in the Pacific to make landfall. Some of the worst damage was in the desert regions of Southern California. The mayor of the city of Palm Springs said there was no way into or out of the city on Monday due to heavy flooding on the roadways.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. A jury in Lewiston this afternoon found James R. Brashear of Winchester guilty of a lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter in a murder trial for killing his ex-son-in-law in 2021. The 69-year-old Brashear shot and killed 40-year-old John Mast of Williston, North Dakota on February 5, 2021 in the Lewiston Rose Hour supermarket parking lot. Mast was in a custody dispute for his children, who are Brashear's grandchildren. The voluntary manslaughter conviction means the jury found Brashear killed as an emotional reaction at the time of the killing and did not find he killed with forethought, which would be required for a first-degree murder conviction. Searchers have found the body of 32-year-old AC DeCoro of Moscow on the Snake River, who went missing Sunday, August 13th, after the jet boat he was in struck a rock in the river. The Idaho County Sheriff's Office reported today DeCora's body was 22 miles from Pittsburgh Landing. Workers for Hammer Down River Excursions of Whitebird found the body yesterday afternoon. Another person missing in Idaho County has not been found. The Lewiston Tribune reports 64-year-old Daniel Yeh of Kuski was picking huckleberries near Canyon Junction in Idaho County when he went missing August 12th. The sheriff's office said daily searches for Yeh continue. And last weekend, an additional 24 ground searches and dog teams were unable to locate Yeh. The sheriff's office said the Idaho County Posse is continuing to patrol and monitor the area where Yeh went missing. The far-right majority on the North Idaho College Board of Trustees has hired a lawyer with extremist ties to be the school's general legal counsel, despite a selection panel giving the attorney the lowest score of the two finalists for the job. The board hired D. Colton Boyles of Boyles Law in Sandpoint as the school's general legal counsel Wednesday. Boyles is a far-right lawyer with extremist ties. The selection panel consisting of school administrators scored Boyles significantly lower than the Stevens Clay Law Firm of Spokane, which specializes in K-12 school law and had the highest ranking from the committee of 97%. Both Boyles and the Clay Law Firm were willing to work for the same price. Also at Wednesday's meeting, the board voted to retain Art McComber, who withdrew as NIC attorney earlier this year, to continue as co-attorney for the school, along with Boyles. The board voted with the same 3-2 majority to keep McComber on. McComber is a controversial figure in his own right, who had the support of the extremist Kootenai County Republican Party Central Committee in his Republican primary bid for Secretary of State last year. McComber had told the board in May his contract with the school would end August 15th, but according to the Coeur d'Alene Press, board member Todd Banducci said before the meeting this week that McComber's contract was extended to continue working on projects, including investigating whether current NIC President Nick Swain had his contract illegally changed by the board when the board temporarily had a 3-2 majority appointed by the State Board of Education last year. When the far right took back control of the board last year, they voted to put Swain on administrative leave and hired Greg South as president, but Swain sued earlier this year and a state district judge ordered NIC to reinstate him. In the process of hiring a new attorney for the school, the selection committee gave Boyles a 60% rating. The far-right majority on the Community Library Board in Kootenai and Shoshone counties recently retained Boyles. That library board, which covers libraries in Kootenai County outside of the city of Coeur d'Alene and part of Shoshone County, had embarked on a campaign to cleanse the shelves of books that validate gay and trans kids. Boyles also represented far-right Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan in the public records lawsuit the Idaho Press Club won against her in 2021, in which McGeehan refused to release public comments that overwhelmingly criticized her so-called indoctrination and education task force. The Spokesman Review reports extreme-right anti-government organizer Eamon Bundy's campaign for governor paid Boyle's law firm $5,000 for legal advice in 2022, and that Boyles is a supporter of Eamon Bundy. An Ada County jury recently awarded St. Luke's Hospital System in the Treasure Valley $52.5 million from Bundy and associate Diego Rodriguez for defamation and harassment after Bundy and Rodriguez took to social media in March of last year claiming Child Protective Services had kidnapped Rodriguez's grandson and were holding the infant hostage at a St. Luke's hospital and called on their supporters to hold an armed protest at St. Luke's main hospital in downtown Boise. That caused the hospital to go on lockdown and forced them to divert incoming ambulances to other hospitals after Bundy's supporters blocked an ambulance bay. Boyle, the new North Idaho College in-house attorney, pushed a deep state conspiracy theory about Child Protective Services in a recent Epoch Times documentary about Bundy and Rodriguez, saying it is a state and federally funded kidnapping system. The Spokesman Review reports the documentary identified Boyles as the attorney for the Rodriguez family. Boyles has also appeared on the far-right internet program, The Pete Santilli Show, whose host was a supporter of Bundy during the armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Central Oregon in 2016. Bundy's armed and maskless groups have on numerous occasions breached or tried to breach government functions that were limited by COVID distancing mandates. In June 2020, before COVID vaccines were available, Bundy's group forced the Southwest Health District Board to shut down a public meeting on health mandates held mostly on Zoom when he strong-armed his way into the meeting room backed by 50 of his maskless supporters. In August 2020, before vaccines were available, Idaho State Police arrested three people, including Bundy, at the state capitol for trespassing after they refused to leave the Lincoln Auditorium when House Speaker Scott Bedke ordered the room cleared during a special legislative session. During the special session, an armed people's rights mob crowded past guards into the House gallery, breaking a glass door and tearing down physical distancing signs requiring observers to sit far apart. In December 2020, a people's rights mob stormed the Central Health District offices where board members were considering issuing a mask mandate in order to save lives in the district, and simultaneously carried out armed nighttime protests at board members' homes in Boise, including one board member's home where her children were home alone, carrying tiki torches and playing amplified clips from the horror movie Scarface. The 2019 Ramparts Report commissioned by the Washington House concluded Bundy participated in domestic terrorism by helping organize the armed Malheur National Wildlife takeover. Boyle's association with Bundy is significant because the far-right majority on the North Idaho College Board fired former NIC President Rick McLennan without cause in 2021, weeks after the board repealed McLennan's campus mask rule during the first week of the fall semester. In a 3-2 vote Wednesday, the North Idaho Board of Trustees members Terry Zimmerman and Brad Corkill voted against hiring Boyles. Zimmerman said at Wednesday's meeting, "How can we put forth someone who scored 60%? That's a D-. I'm not saying that Boyles is a failure, but in terms of competition with other candidates, he doesn't compete. We're supposed to do what's in the best interest of North Idaho College." Board Chair Greg McKenzie and board members Todd Banducci and Mike Wagoner voted to hire Boyles. Wagoner said he based his decision on Clay's relative inexperience in higher education and discounted the Clay Law Firm's forte in Title IX public school law, which is a federal law which prohibits discrimination based on gender at schools that accept federal funding. Wagoner said, "I have concerns about what's really going to be provided." Unlike Clay, Boyles provided none of the additional information the NIC board requested in June, including years of experience in insurance coverage negotiations and experience representing higher education clients and any criminal or civil suits he might have incurred in the past 7 years. Boyles wrote in an email to the board after receiving the request for additional information, "It has become clear to me that the group of administrators conducting the request for qualifications review are biased against me and my firm and that we are not being fairly considered. The board is, however, welcome to reach out to me directly if it requires any further information." North Idaho College Vice President of Finance Sarah Garcia followed up by sending an email to Boyles clarifying the new questions came from the NIC Board of Trustees, not administrators, but Boyles did not respond to that email. The Spokesman Review reported Board Chair Greg McKenzie cut off NIC President Nick Swain at Wednesday's meeting when Swain brought up Boyles' lack of response. Zimmerman said Boyle's engagement agreement is a, quote, hot mess, unquote, due to a provision which requires the school to, quote, waive in advance any conflict that might result, unquote, in Boyle's representing clients who have disputes with NIC. She also said Boyle's has been combative. Zimmerman said Boyles has been accusatory. He's been combative to the very people he's applying to work for. His refusal to complete the interview process disqualifies him. McComber advised the board not to hire Boyles until they first struck the conflict clause outlined in the contract. That did not happen. The actions followed months of uncertainty about the college's legal counsel. In April and May of this year, the board first hired and then reversed a decision to hire Boise firm Holland and Hart as legal counsel. Holland and Hart has 400 attorneys. According to the Coeur d'Alene Press, McKenzie closed Wednesday's meeting saying, "Colton Boyles, congratulations. You are general counsel. I encourage you to watch this board meeting and kind of understand the different various sentiments of board members and their various concerns." The vote did not sit well with some of the meeting's attendees. A college employee yelled from the back of the meeting room at the Edminster Student Union building, "You are ruining us." Earlier in the meeting, board member Zimmerman referred to the fact NIC remains under sanctions from its accreditation agency, the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, because of unresolved issues involving governance, declining enrollment, and finances. Zimmerman said, We are one bad board meeting away from losing accreditation. According to Bonner County Clerk Michael Rosedale, voter turnout for next week's recall election against West Bonner Board of Trustees Chair Keith Rutledge and Vice Chair Susan Brown is expected to be twice of what it was 2 years ago. Rutledge and Brown are facing the recall election from voters displeased with their hiring of far-right Idaho Freedom Foundation staffer Brandon Durst as district superintendent, who they say is unqualified for the position because he does not meet the State Board of Education's requirement of working in a school for 4 years to receive a superintendent certificate and has not applied for an emergency certificate. Durst is a former top analyst for the Idaho Freedom Foundation, which is an anti-education group whose leaders have said they would like to eliminate publicly funded education in Idaho and have smeared educators in the state for what they claim is indoctrination in social justice and critical race theory. Durst also ran in last year's Republican primary for state superintendent of public instruction, losing to State Board of Education President Debbie Critchfield, who went on to win the general election. The Board of Trustees approved Durst's contract on a 3-2 vote in June, with board member Margaret Hall and board member Carly Barton voting no. Voters elected Rutledge and Brown, who both voted in favor of Durst's contract in 2021, with Rutledge receiving 485 votes and Brown receiving 359 votes. Following Durst's controversial hiring, some parents and patrons in the district said they were planning to recall Rutledge and Brown. Rosedale said, "I believe there will be a much higher than normal turnout, certainly much higher than when they were elected the first time. There's huge interest in this." Rosedale said next week's election could easily top 2,000 ballots cast out of 3,411 registered voters. The Spokesman Review reports as of Wednesday, district patrons had already cast 300 votes, with 244 absentee ballots and 59 early voter ballots. Rosedale said voting will take place Tuesday, August 29th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at five county precincts located in Old Town, West Priest River, East Priest River, Edgemire, and Laclede. He said Tuesday you can vote at your precinct and only at your precinct, not at the administration building. Rosedale said there will be poll watchers at each of the five precincts who are supposed to follow his guidelines. He said, "Usually we don't get poll watchers, but we have watchers for recall and against recall at every precinct. If there are any questions, they call me directly. They cannot be in a position to see how you vote. The world can know you voted, but the world is not allowed to know what your selection was when you voted." Rosedale said he only knows of one complaint, which concerned a poster-sized tarp on some businesses supporting the recall, which did not include language regarding who paid for them. He said the recall election's costs are expected to be around $18,000 out of the county's budget, with expenses including the rental of the Priest River Event Center, ballot printing, the hiring of poll workers, rental truck expenses, and the publishing of public notices in newspapers. At a town hall meeting Tuesday, Brown and Rutledge celebrated their accomplishments while on the Board of Trustees, saying they are resolute in their belief the community wants change. Brown said, "I hope that people will give Mr. Durst a chance at his job. I can tell you with the conversations I've had with him, he wholeheartedly really does want to do some fabulous things with the school district." Rutledge said, "We need a fresh culture, and that's exactly what we were looking at when we were looking for a superintendent. Over half of the district wants change, and that's what we've done." The West Bonner County School District Board of Trustees approved a policy for the new school year last week that bans female trans athletes from competing in girls' sports in the district and requires trans athletes to use restrooms and locker rooms and requires trans students to use restrooms and locker rooms that correspond to their biological sex at birth and not their preferred gender. The district's new policy also prohibits district staff from referring to students with their chosen gender pronouns other than the pronoun corresponding to the student's biological sex at birth. The ban says employees and all representatives of the district shall refer to a student by their biological sex unless otherwise expressly agreed to in writing by district administration and the student's parent or legal guardian. Newly installed West Bonner Superintendent Brandon Durst, recently of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, has bypassed the school board's legal counsel in reviewing the policy. According to the spokesman review, Durst instead sent the policy to the attorneys with the right-wing Alliance Defending Freedom of Scottsdale, Arizona, for review. The Alliance is a conservative Christian advocacy group that has promoted bigoted anti-LGBTQ policies and promotes trans athlete bans in other states. The West Bonner School District's news release about the new policy went out last Thursday, the same day the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a temporary injunction against Idaho's statewide trans athlete ban law in a lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of two trans athletes. The release promoted the so-called Fairness in Women's Sports Act, saying the new policy, quote, ensures that girls have an equal opportunity to compete and excel in sports without facing inherent physiological differences that could impact the fairness of the competitions. The news release implied the new policy is in the best interest of students. It said, by asserting its autonomy, the West Bonner County School District takes a stand against any form of federal tyranny that could infringe upon its ability to make decisions that are in the best interest of students. And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by the Moscow Food Co-op, specializing in food, goods, and programs that nourish and nurture our community. The Moscow Food Co-op is located at 121 East 5th Street. For more information, visit moscowfood.coop, call 882-8537, or find them on Facebook.
Time shifting. The KRFP 2-Week Archive.
KRFP now has a full archive of all of its shows, local and syndicated, on the KRFP website.
Did you ever miss your favorite KRFP program and wish you could still listen to it? Did you ever want to explore some of KRFP's 97 weekly shows that are on while you're at work or asleep? Did you ever want to listen again to that show you caught on the car radio?
Well, now you can. The KRFP show archive is now active. Listen to all your favorite KRFP shows when you want to. Click the heart on the KRFP website and immediately listen to any show from the last 2 weeks, local or syndicated, talk or music, serious or funny.
Listen to drive time shows in the middle of the night. Listen to insomniac shows in the middle of the afternoon. We're there when you want us.
KRFP on demand. Listen to all local KRFP radio shows when you want to hear them, where you want to hear them, on the internet.
Please leave a message so I know what had happened.
This is your radio. I want you to get back with me. I'm at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. This is your radio in Moscow, Idaho.
The Whitman County Sheriff's Office says two juveniles from Moscow, ages 13 and 14, are responsible for starting a fire that burned a bridge on the Chipman Trail between Moscow and Pullman last Saturday. The trail is currently closed, and Whitman County's Parks and Recreation says the department is working on temporary solutions to reopen the section of the trail as quickly as possible. Whitman County Parks and Recreation Director Bill Tensfeld says the bridge is still standing but is not salvageable. He said a structural engineer will visit the bridge to see if pedestrians and bikers can cross it, but bridge will have to be rebuilt either this fall or next spring because it must be able to take the weight of a fire truck. A semi-truck struck and killed a 34-year-old plumber resident who was a pedestrian on U.S. Highway 95 in Benoit County last week. According to the Spokesman Review, an Idaho State Patrol news release said the semi, driven by a 64-year-old Post Falls man, was traveling north on U.S. Highway 95 when it struck the pedestrian near the intersection of the highway and DeSmet Road. The release said the man was walking in the northbound lane before being struck, and first responders pronounced him dead at the scene. The police report says an investigation is underway. The highway was closed for about 3.5 hours. Washington Department of Agriculture officials are urging large animal owners to protect and closely monitor their animals as smoke from wildfires poses significant health risks to their pets and livestock. According to the Agriculture Department, symptoms include irritation to the eyes, respiratory tract problems, aggravation of chronic lung diseases, and reduced respiratory functions. When particulates are in high concentrations, they can cause constant coughs, nasal discharges, wheezing, and breathing problems. Particulate matter can weaken immune systems and impair lung functions and their ability to filter out foreign matter such as pollen and bacteria to which the animals are exposed. The Agriculture Department says animal owners can take safeguards, including limiting exercise when smoke is present, avoiding strenuous activities that increase lung airflows, providing fresh water at feeding areas, reducing dust exposure by using feeds which are low dust or dust-free, and misting or sprinkling water in livestock pens to reduce dust. When the air quality improves, animal owners should allow livestock 4 to 6 weeks to recover before moving, handling, or transporting them. The Ag Department says good barn and field conditions are crucial to minimizing fire dangers to horses and other barn animals. That can include safe, stable structures, prompt removal of dead trees, dry brush, and maintaining a defensible space around the buildings. The department also recommends to ensure animal safety, owners should drain and clean exposed stock tanks, wash fire retardant residue from structures, rinse vegetation, thoroughly wash garden produce, shampoo pets, and take assessments of pasture and grazing lands for contagions. Officials with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration say updated COVID-19 vaccines, influenza shots, and the newly approved respiratory syncytial virus vaccine are expected to be available next month. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, the Biden administration is making preparations for a vaccine campaign this fall. According to one official, we're going to encourage Americans to get their COVID-19 vaccine in addition to their annual flu shot, as well as the immunizations for RSV for people who are over the age of 60, as well as for infants. The Centers for Disease Control says RSV is a virus which causes mild cold-like symptoms but can become serious at times. Four representatives with the agencies spoke to reporters about the plan for the fall campaign, but did not comment on how many people the government is targeting for the campaign. The representatives stressed the importance heading into the flu season. The same official said, "We can't speculate or predict where it will ultimately land, but our goal is for that number of uptake to be as high as possible." The official said the Biden administration hopes to provide booster shots for the uninsured and underinsured. According to a second administration official, the new COVID-19 vaccine will target the new variant known as EG5, which now is the dominant strain. The official said one of the manufacturers has already made it clear that when testing their vaccine against the EG5 variant, that it looks like the neutralization is robust. So I think that's a good harbinger. The official said more data is needed for the updated vaccines expected to impact the BA2.86 variant. He said, I think we feel comfortable in saying that it's likely that the vaccine will help protect against the severe outcomes that would occur. So we'll obviously have more data that will come in the next few weeks. The first official said, we are focused on getting older individuals their vaccines, partly because they have been a higher proportion of hospitalizations throughout the pandemic. And you're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by the Environmental Defense Institute, actively engaged with issues involving the Idaho National Laboratory, a Department of Energy nuclear site. EDI advocates for environmentally sound nuclear policy decisions.
We now turn to our featured segment. On Tuesday, the University of Idaho Malcolm M. Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium held a panel discussion with seven University of Idaho employees on generative artificial intelligence text applications and how they impact academics and the classroom. The outline for the colloquium said generative artificial intelligence text applications such as ChatGPT have quickly changed the landscape of academia and raised significant questions about academic integrity. ChatGPT has passed a host of academic exams, including law, MBA, SAT, and others, and can answer to varying degrees of success most of the questions we ask students. At the same time, generative AI applications can serve as powerful dialogic, research, and communications tools with the potential to increase educational access and outcomes. Therefore, our Renfrew Colloquium topic focuses on the question, as generative AI tools change the academic landscape, how should educators change with them, pursuing AI's benefits while ensuring our students put in the hard work of learning? This panel consists of instructors who investigated the utility of AI tools in their practice during the spring 2023 semester. While the panel may offer some guidance, we intend this session to be an exploration of the topic that may spur new ideas for your research and teaching and help you make informed, intentional decisions about generative AI that is appropriate to your discipline and the learning goals you have for students. The panelists are Writing Center Director Jamaica Richter, Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning Assistant Director of Programming Douglas Habib, Andrea Ingram of the Office of the Dean of Students, Diane Carter, who is a Psychology and Communications Professor, Politics and Philosophy Department Chair Bert Baumgartner, English professor and director of composition, Tyler Easterbrook, and mechanical engineering professor, Dan Corden. The first voice is Renfrew Colloquium founder, Kenton Bird.
Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium for Tuesday, August 22nd, 2023. And that number is significant because we are beginning our 23rd year of this cross-campus interdisciplinary conversation about teaching and research and outreach and all kinds of the intellectual activities that go on at the University of Idaho. So thank you for being with us on this journey. And I'm Kenton Bird, and I have the honor of co-coordinating the series with my colleague Dan Buckvich from the School of Music. And Dan was one of the founders of this series on the auspicious date of 9/11/01. If you can put yourself in that mindset of 22 years ago, and the colloquium went ahead as scheduled on that date, and with just a few exceptions going every Tuesday at this time during the fall and spring semesters. Before introducing today's panel, I would like to make two short announcements. One is I'm still working on the schedule for the fall semester. So if you or a colleague have a topic that would lend itself to this format, we would be thrilled to have you make a proposal. And several people in this room have presented in the past, and several have agreed to present in the future. So that's a possibility. Bert, I think we might be hearing from you in a couple weeks with Florian.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Not on your own.
I only look 1 week ahead.
That's all I do either. So the other announcement is this is an undergraduate class. INTR 450 is a one-credit upper division pass-fail course that fulfills a variety of general education and free elective requirements. And so if you're an undergrad student or you know an undergrad student, please encourage them. It's still possible to add, and there are some minimal writing assignments and a couple of class discussions over the course of the semester in addition to regular attendance at the colloquium. Today's panel originated in a series of email messages last spring when I was dealing with an academic integrity issue involving the use of AI by a couple of students in my 100-level media and society course. And we continued to correspond, and I'm grateful to Jamaica Richter and to Doug Habib for sort of embracing the topic and suggesting that it would lend itself to a good faculty panel with some of the members of the faculty who've been part of the AI faculty conversation group last spring. And then as the panel came together, I realized it was too much for a single week, that there's many dimensions to generative artificial intelligence, and that so this is actually just part one of the conversation, and next week we'll continue the conversation, same time, same bat channel here in the music building, so I hope you'll come back for that. But let me turn the program over to Jamaica, who will frame some of the big questions, and then Doug will pose the questions to our three panelists today.
Thank you, Kenton. Hello, everyone. I'm Jamaica Richter. I'm the director of the Writing Center and really pleased to be here with you all today. You all know something of generative AI, which is why you're here, and you no doubt know that it is not a simple topic. It poses benefits. It increases access for many people to discourse communities that would not have had access or have had limited access in the past. It can make our work, make us more productive in our work. Maybe that's a good thing or a benefit, I'm not sure. And it can function as a really powerful individualized learning tool, among other things. AI also poses harm. It potentially can flatten the English language variation to a more generic, machine-inflected, standard version. Its development is known to exploit workers through from very under-resourced areas. And, of course, it raises questions, like many of us are concerned about here today, it raises questions about academic integrity and learning. So how to balance all of that? Last semester, as Kenton mentioned, Zad Habib Seidel began a faculty study group to explore this tool and many of these questions and to think about what role it might have in our classrooms. Some people would say none. Others are more actively embracing it. And depending on your perception, depending on the field that you're in, it's interesting to see what people are doing and what the outcomes are. Of the many ideas and suggestions circulating in education conversations about AI, the recommendations that have stood out to me are that it's really important as educators to be educating ourselves about generative AI to understand and decide for ourselves whether to use it, and if so, how, to develop very clear policies for that use, and then to communicate those policies often and loudly to our students. And that's a lot to sort of take in and internalize and hold a position on from one semester to the next. So to that end, for today and next week, Doug and Andrea Ingram from the Dean of Students Office and I have organized this panel, trying to bring in people from a range of fields who can talk about the experiences that they have had with generative AI in their classrooms, what they hope to do with it, how they hope to make it work for them, fears or apprehensions, I suppose is maybe the better word, or things they're really excited about going forward, so that we can have a richer and more well-informed idea about how AI can be helpful to us and how we can use it, if we choose to use it, to really support learning, writing, communication, access for our students. So with that, I will turn it over to Doug. He has a series of questions again next week. You'll hear probably a number of similar questions, but the people who we have on the panel have different backgrounds, different experiences. So between the two, you should get a very wide range of ideas that, again, will hopefully inform your decision-making and your thoughts going forward. So, Doug.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Ida Deed. I work for the Center for Excellence Teaching and Learning, and as of March of last year, got interested in AI because faculty came to me and were interested about AI, so it came about that. Before I get to my questions, though, I would like the folks to have an opportunity just to introduce themselves to you, who they are, what they're doing here, in terms of teaching.
All right. So I'm Diane Carter. I'm the course director for the COM 101 Oral Communication course here at the university. And I was one of those people in March going, oh my word, how do we stop students from just letting a machine write their work?
Hi, everyone. I'm Andrea Ingram. I am the Assistant Director of Conduct and Community Standards in the Dean of Students Office. Diane is the reason I'm here. Yes. Diane sent me so many students in March with ChatGPT issues that I didn't know what to do either. So we were absolutely learning together.
I'm Burt Baumgartner. I'm the chair of the Department of Politics and Philosophy. I teach courses in logic and philosophy of language, which is, I'm teaching philosophy of language when ChatGPT came up. I'm about to teach a metaphysics class this fall semester, and I'm actually really, really excited about this tool. I started using it as a research assistant myself, and so I'm trying to figure out how I can utilize it for my classes, since students are going to have access to it in the workforce. My thinking is, might as well teach them how to use it well.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And I just did want to play, or not play, be, have full disclosure with you, just in terms of my own interest and perspective on this, since I'm the moderator, and I want to be moderate in that. I look at it myself when I first came across it in a very ambivalent kind of way. It's kind of like fire to me. It's a neat tool that can do things for us and can destroy everything we hold dear. So I'm trying to wrestle with both of these things, and I find that for me the best thing to do is to try to figure out what's the impact on our learning. You know, and the big question I have, I think it can be helpful. I think it could be harmful. I wonder if there's a way to use it in such a way that it is not training wheels that never go away. And that's kind of where I'm coming at here. So the questions I ask are really very open-ended and based on your experiences. And I'm asking them because I'm really kind of interested in how you're dealing with the situation. And kind of to the big question I have is how do we keep these training wheels from being things that never go away? So that's my general approach. But I'm interested in yours. So the first question I have is, I need my glasses for this. and you can take these in turn, but how have AI generative text tools supported or interfered with learning in your classes?
So are we going this way all the time?
Or,
okay. All right. Talk first.
Am I right? Like a card game.
So how has the AI impacted our classes? Okay, so in March, you know, we all kind of came upon AI at the same time. So students started to use tools like ChatGPT to generate their work. And at that point, I thought, oh my gosh, this is terrible. It's awful. But when the opportunity came to join the faculty group, I decided, I should probably figure out how to deal with it, like how to make it stop. But while I was in the faculty group, this amazing thing happened because people in different disciplines started talking about how they could use it, how students could benefit from it. And so as a result of that, I started to see it much more as a tool. And like any tool, it sort of depends on the tool itself. Is it being used for the right purpose? And is the person using it have some skill? So that's sort of how I've approached preparation for fall. And so at this juncture, I've changed some assignments in Comm 101, changed the syllabus in Comm 101, but I elected not to say, you know, no, you may not under any circumstances use it. I would rather our students have a good foundational knowledge about how to use it ethically and effectively.
Thanks. Same question to you.
Or should I defer to Bert? I'm not an instructor in a classroom. I mean, I can certainly speak to my role. So my role is to receive all kinds of referrals from instructors on anything to do with academic dishonesty. So when I started to receive these in great abundance from Diane, you know, it took a minute to kind of correlate it with the student code and take a look and see, okay, how does this fit into our student code of conduct and how can we hold students accountable when they might not even be sure that they are doing something wrong or against the code of conduct. So through some conversations with students and also with faculty, I've really just kind of determined that the best course of action is that full transparency with the students and to really as instructors and faculty members to have that conversation with your students and to let them know what is and is not prohibited in your classroom. I think without having those conversations and a lot of instructors didn't know how to have those conversations yet because they didn't really know what they were dealing with. So I think it was fair to give students a little bit of a grace period and faculty a little bit of a grace period during that time. So, you know, my best recommendation for how to use this as a tool would just be to have full transparency with your students and to put something in your syllabus that addresses how you would like to use AI in your course, or how, if you would like it to be prohibited in your course, to be super specific. Now I feel like I'm rambling, but I'll just keep going. To spell it out too, I think some students don't know what ChatGPT is. They don't know what artificial intelligence tools are still. Some of them have a lot more knowledge, some of them have very little knowledge, so absolutely just making it very, very clear in your syllabus what you do and do not condone. I probably rambled on too much, but I will pass it to Bert.
So my very first exposure in the classroom to ChatGPT was when I was teaching philosophy of language in fall semester last year. And in November, when model 3.5 was released, that made a huge advancement in terms of how well it does, in terms of the kind of interactions you can have with it. And I had a student come up to me, a relatively sophisticated student, that just admitted, like, I am so tempted to use this for writing essays. And so, like, huge kudos to the student who, like, came to me and was like, what do I do? How do I fight this temptation? So we came up with a really cool assignment where I was like, let's test out the limits of this thing. So let's see, have it try to write some of the essays, and then you critique the responses that it did. And so I had the student use certain kind of highlighting techniques so that I could see very clearly, this is the ChatGPT response, this is what the student's own text was. So the spring semester then, as I started thinking about the sort of uses of it. I fortunately was teaching symbolic logic, where there isn't a lot of essay writing. It's problem set solving. So I didn't have to worry about it as much at that time, but I was sort of in the back burner thinking, like, how am I going to work with this when the fall semester comes and we're teaching another class like metaphysics? So the key thing, like, that I noticed with some of the students who were talking about it is a general overconfidence to treat it as a kind of, like, Wikipedia, like, extra special. All you got to do is give it the essay prompt and then just copy and paste. But sophisticated students realize pretty quickly that there's, like, a lack of context and, like, that kind of thing doesn't do well. More sophisticated students learn to treat it more like a dialogical partner. So the first thing you get back is not quite the right thing to do. You can actually interact with it, and ChatGPT is extremely good at keeping track of the sort of conversational context. So sophisticated students, especially if they know about Model 4.0, for which you do have to pay for, it is even more advanced than 3.5. So it's really impressive. The sophisticated students will know how to use it very, very well. Students who aren't yet aware of it might treat it like a kind of Wikipedia search engine.
Thanks. Yeah. Oh, and I did want to point out, we do want to have time at the towards the end of our time here together for you to ask questions of people who have worked with ChatGPT and thinking about it in their classroom. So I don't want this to become just me talking with all y'all, as lovely as you are. Mm-hmm. So yeah. My next question, I think, Diane, you kind of teased this when you were talking about plans for this semester. And so my second question is based on that. If you're looking to deal with use AI during the semester, what does that look like in your classes? How are you thinking of doing that?
Psychology and Communications Professor Diane Carter.
So Common One, as many of you probably know, is taught almost entirely by TAs. I teach a section. Everybody else is not me. So the training, right, the first thing is that I needed to train the TAs to not only understand what's allowed and what's not, but to be able to talk about these kinds of tools in a clear way. So we have identified some assignments. ChatGPT might be great for helping a student come up with a speech topic that is not just one of the ones that's on all the lists that are out there on Google when you search. Right, so it might offer students an opportunity to think a little bit more deeply about how they could really target a topic. So we're going to present that in a class discussion as a tool. But probably the tool that the assignment that I like best, that I'm most proud of right now, we'll see how it works, is we have an annotated bibliography assignment. It happens early in the semester. It's designed to help students conduct the research that they will then use in their speeches. And in the past, I've had students use a variety of different types of tools to try to find sources and then to assess the value of those sources for their speeches. So I took out actually a newspaper database that wasn't necessarily always going to be relevant to students if they weren't talking about some kind of current event, and I replaced it with go to this OpenAI and use this tool. And what I anticipate will happen, close your ears if you're a student, what I anticipate will happen is that because students have to assess what they find, and we are going to require them to actually go to the source, I think they're going to find some of those shortcomings, right? So they're going to discover, for example, that some of the reference materials that they're pointed to are things that they will never be able to get their hands on, at least not without paying a whole bunch of money. They're going to discover that some of the sources are really esoteric or very, very old or don't exist at all as far as they can find. So it will help them to, I hope, see this thing as a tool that has some strengths and some weaknesses, and that they shouldn't just take everything that they get back after they type a prompt in as sort of, this is perfect. So I'm hoping that it's a learning tool for, we can use it for research, but you can't just take what it gives you and plop it in and think it's going to be good. So that's an assignment we're incorporating into all of our sections this semester. And because that whole assignment is designed to help them assess different ways of getting information, this is just one more possibility, one more tool, if you will.
Politics and Philosophy Department Chair Bert Baumgartner.
So 2 years ago, I taught the metaphysics class that I'm about to teach again this fall semester. And the way that I structured that class is students, I give a little mini lecture of what students can expect in the reading for next week. They're then responsible for doing that reading and writing a weekly paper on it that they then bring to class the following week. And so we spend the first half of the class working in small groups where what they try to do is look at each other's papers where they've effectively reconstructed some argument in the text and then provided some kind of criticism of that. And they work together to try to formulate a master argument, as I call it, for the small group. So students are quite good at detecting like mistakes that the others have made, but they sometimes are blind towards their own mistakes. And so there's something about that kind of dialogue that really helps. For those of you who've ever taken a philosophy class and think about Socratic dialogues, right? I mean, that's a key part of doing philosophy, is interacting with someone else and having this dialogical nature. So I try to incorporate that in metaphysics class-style context. The way that I'm going to try to incorporate ChatGPT in this process, and there is a study that I'm doing for this class, IRB approval number, is to encourage students to use ChatGPT as much as they would like when they're working on their weekly papers. And then in the in-class component, I will break things into groups. I'm expecting about four groups each week, where they'll randomly be assigned into one of those four groups. And two of those groups will be encouraged to use ChatGPT. There'll be one person that'll be interacting with ChatGPT, and the other two groups not. Are there any students in here?
Yeah.
Earmuffs?
Plug yours.
So, the hypothesis is that every student will be in a group with ChatGPT about half the time over the course of the semester. So there'll be equal access to this. I'm just trying to look to see if there's an effect with access to ChatGPT in general. So the idea is that those groups that have access to ChatGPT will write better group papers than those who don't. So there's means of how I'm going to assess that at the end of the semester, so stay tuned on that. The interesting challenge that I've run into is it's easy enough to say it's a dialogical partner, but there's all sorts of things that happen in a group context that ChatGPT is not hearing. And so there's a really interesting question: how does this sort of like secretary of the group sort of translate what's been discussed so far and then write that into ChatGPT? And one of the first assignments that I'm going to have them do to sort of just test run some of the stuff is just start with the question like, what is a sandwich? So the goal is to come up with a criteria for what a sandwich is, and then for other members of the group to come up with criticisms of that. And if any of you followed this on like Reddit or some other memes, right, there's questions about, does a burrito count as a sandwich? Does a hot dog count as a sandwich? Does an open-faced sandwich count as a sandwich? So I'm trying to start this with fun to sort of like test drive this, but that's how I'm trying to get to use it. I've tested it myself and a graduate student in psychology, Zeth, who's actually here today as well, has been helping with me. And we've been playing around with it a lot. And there's some interesting nuances that it provides, too, about like cultural context. So you can explore those kinds of nuances. And you can get it to like give me an example that is different from these criteria, or try to develop some criteria that handles these kinds of questions. So in the same way as you might try to talk to Socrates is how I'm kind of imagining what this tool is like.
Yeah. UI Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning, Associate Director of Programming, Douglas Habib.
It's interesting. Remember, I was fiddling around with it over the summer, and I asked it, so, okay, in the voice of Alex from Clockwork Orange, how would you describe a good day? And it gave me 600 words on a nice little use of language from Clockwork Orange and all that kind of thing. But it was 600 words. And I sat sitting in, no, really, how would you describe it? And then the second response was, it was a horror show day. So it's got this interesting little thing in there, and I have no idea how it did that. Yeah, whether it got fed up or... I don't know. But yeah, and interesting the kind of different responses you get asking the same or very similar kind of question. It's fascinating. And I wonder what it does do to people's... to their whole learning process. Is there anything, I guess my next question here, anything you would do in terms of recommendations or any kind of guidance that you can give to your colleagues here? Is there anything that really excites you about it or is you kind of ambivalent about? What is you really don't like about it? Anything that you can say to your colleagues?
Well,
as they wrestle about it.
I think that if I had been around 50, I don't know, 75 years ago, we'd be having this conversation about the calculator or, you know, the telephone or later the cell phone. And so I really feel like it's a tool. So I think that our task is twofold. One, we need to understand the tool, like you said. And then number two, we need to help our students figure out how to use the tool most effectively. I feel like U of I students should not leave this institution sort of unable to use a tool that people are going to be using in their workplaces when they get there. I think the goal is very much to prepare them for that, but not allow them to short-circuit their learning, which is why in Comm 101, the syllabus very clearly says, do not use this to generate your outline. Right? You can use it for this purpose and this purpose and this purpose. These are great. Don't let it write your outline for you. And a lot of how we caught a lot of the early people who had some issues was, sure, the tool in Canvas was sort of flagging things, but also you could just read them and go, this person does not sound like this. They've never written like this. Something has fundamentally changed. So we want students to be able to develop their own voice. We want them to be able to think and reason effectively. So I think we can't pass that on to somebody else to do. So, and in Comm 101, that's where we're starting. And the syllabus language says we want you to practice the skills of generating your own work. We want you to practice the critical thinking skills. Once you have those down, then you can start to apply them in an upper division class in really unique and special ways. But let's start here. Let's start in a reasonable sort of beginning point so that we can get to where we want to go.
Yeah, I think that's really important, is to identify what skills or practices you're trying to teach your students, or that they get practice with, to say, no, we're practicing with this because I want you to develop it now, and then you can work with it and you can play with it.
One more thing, and that is in public speaking, right? Students prepare an outline, they prepare their comments, and then they deliver the speech. And one of the things that speech people have known for a very long time is that speeches are kind of like icebergs, and giving the speech is the little pointy part on the top. But, you know, you need that foundational stuff that's under the surface. And so if you're letting a computer or some kind of software generate that for you, it'll actually make it more difficult for you to give a speech, because it won't be your speech.
And a graduate student in psychology, Zeth, who's actually here today as well, has been helping with me. And we've been playing around with it a lot. And there's some interesting nuances that it provides, too, about, like, cultural context. So you can explore those kinds of nuances. And you can get it to, like, give me an example that is different from these criteria, or try to develop some criteria that handles these kinds of questions. So in the same way as you might try to talk to Socrates is how I'm kind of imagining what this tool is like.
UI Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning, Associate Director of Programming, Douglas Habib.
It's interesting. Remember, I was fiddling around with it over the summer, and I asked it, so, okay, in the voice of Alex from Clockwork Orange, how would you describe a good day? And it gave me 600 words on a nice little use of language from Clockwork Orange and all kind of thing. But it was 600 words. And I sat sitting in, no, really, how would you describe it? And then the second response was, it was a horror show day. So it's got this interesting little thing in there, and I have no idea how it did that. Yeah, whether it got fed up or I don't know. But yeah, and interesting the kind of different responses you get asking the same or very similar kind of question. It's fascinating. And I wonder what it does do to people's, to their whole learning process. Is there anything, I guess my next question here, anything you would do in terms of recommendations or any kind of guidance that you can give to your colleagues here? Is there anything that really excites you about it, or that you're kind of ambivalent about, or that you really don't like about it? Anything that you can say to your colleagues as they wrestle about it?
I think that if I had been around 50, I don't know, 75 years ago, we would be having this conversation about the calculator or, you know, the telephone or later the cell phone. And so I really feel like it's a tool. So I think that our task is twofold. One, we need to understand the tool, like you said. And then number two, we need to help our students figure out how to use the tool most effectively. I feel like U of I students should not leave this institution sort of unable to use a tool that people are going to be using in their workplaces when they get there. I think the goal is very much to prepare them for that, but not allow them to short-circuit their learning, which is why in Comm 101, the syllabus very clearly says, do not use this to generate your outline, right? You can use it for this purpose and this purpose and this purpose. These are great. Don't let it write your outline for you. And a lot of how we caught a lot of the early people who had some issues was, sure, the tool in Canvas was sort of flagging things, but also you could just read them and go, this person does not sound like this, they've never written like this, something has fundamentally changed. So we want students to be able to develop their own voice, we want them to be able to think and reason effectively. So I think it's, we can't sort of, I don't think we can just sort of pass it on to somebody else to do. So, and in Common One, that's where we're starting. And the syllabus language says we want you to practice the skills of generating your own work. We want you to practice the critical thinking skills. Once you have those down, then you can start to apply them in an upper division class in really unique and special ways. But let's start here. Let's start in a reasonable sort of beginning point so that we can get to where we want to go.
Yeah, that's really important, is to identify what skills or practices you're trying to teach your students or that they get practice with, to say, no, we're practicing with this because I want you to develop it now, and then you can work with it and you can play with it.
One more thing, and that is in public speaking, right? Students prepare an outline, they prepare their comments, and then they deliver the speech. And one of the things that speech people have known for a very long time is that speeches are kind of like icebergs. And giving the speech is the little pointy part on the top. But, you know, you need that foundational stuff that's under the surface. And so if you're letting a computer or some kind of software generate that for you, it'll actually make it more difficult for you to give a speech because it won't be your speech.
And you're tuned in to the University of Idaho Malcolm Renfrew Colloquium, which was held this past Tuesday on generative artificial intelligence text applications and their impacts on academics. We'll return with the conclusion of this panel discussion in just a moment. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, and you're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by Hotchins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hotchins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hotchins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hotchins at 208-882-5536.
Foreign detainees at Guantanamo Bay, who are still there.
America the beautiful, aspirational, welcoming place.
Do not have the right to make due process claims in court.
Or America the fearful, bitter, resentful, petty, not enough for all you foreigners place.
Peace Radio is back.
This is equally bummer.
Dear Mr. President.
Every other Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. here on KRFP 90.3 FM and online.
Pardoned by Trump.
You'll find that Native Americans are familiar with the idea that a pandemic is a great time for capitalists to make a profit.
Every other Sunday.
Much of Bezos' new wealth is a result of changing consumer habits during the pandemic.
This is a message to my people, man. I know we only fighting to feel equal. Damn, use your words.
You have to stop. My eyes can't roll back any further.
People with no deceitful plan. Nah, stand together, we'll be better in the end. I'm only reaching out. I got a hand that I can lend. I hope.
Next episode, Sunday, August 27th, 2 to 4 p.m.
As a doctor, I've seen too many women with breast cancer who could have avoided extensive treatment or even death had they just gotten an annual mammogram. Every major medical organization experienced in breast cancer recommends annual mammograms for women 40 and older. Please, if you're 40 or older, get a mammogram every year. If you have a family history or other risk factors, talk to your doctor about what's right for you. To find an accredited center, visit mammographysaveslives.org.
Good evening, and you're tuned to the KRFP Evening Report. We're going to get to the conclusion of this week's Malcolm M. Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium, which was held at the University of Idaho on Tuesday. There was a 7-person panel, and the topic was Generative Artificial Intelligence Text Applications and Their Impacts on Academics. The panelists were Writing Center Director Jamaica Richter, Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning Assistant Director of Programming Douglas Habib, Andrea Ingram of the Office of the Dean of Students, Psychology and Communication Professor Diane Carter, Politics and Philosophy Department Chair Bert Baumgartner, English Professor and Director of Composition at the UI Tyler Easterbrook, and Mechanical Engineering Professor Dan Corden.
So that's also something we're really trying to reinforce with our students.
Thank you. Andrea, anything you'd say to your colleagues?
Andrea Ingram of the Office of the Dean of Students.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a reiteration, but I would say when I am in partnership with you for an academic dishonesty referral, your syllabus is one of the very first things that I look at. So when a student says, my instructor never once told me I couldn't use ChatGPT, I'm going to ask you, can I see your syllabus? And I'm going to look at your syllabus and see, what do you address in your syllabus under academic dishonesty? Mm-hmm. Is it just, do you just link to the academic dishonesty policy in our student code of conduct? Or are you really specific? Are you saying, in my course, you may not use ChatGPT, you may not use outside sources? This is a little nod for one of the instructors in the class, but you may not use Chegg.com. You know, whatever you're prohibiting, please spell it out. That's going to make my job super easy, but it's also going to help the student when they're saying, no, wait a minute, you know, nobody told me this. And granted, not every student reads their syllabus, right? They're not reading that on the first day of class like you want them to. They're overwhelmed. They might not be taking in all of the information. So having that conversation more than once, more than twice, more than three times, so that they really understand what it is you're talking about and what is okay for them. And then if they mess up, also having those educational conversations. I mean, it's okay to have those even before you refer them to the Dean of Students Office or to me. I really appreciate the instructors that have those conversations with the students and just say, okay, I see, I can kind of tell that this is not your voice, like Diane said. Now, let me just say also, I have read conduct essays or outcomes that I have assigned to students as a consequence, if you will, for a conduct matter, and read it and thought, oh, there's no way. There's no way that this student wrote this. I've met this student. This is not his voice. And so I send an email back and I say, sir, you know, I just read your essay. Is there any way you used an outside source or did you by chance access ChatGPT to write this essay? And then I wait and then I get a response typically that says, I did. Was that okay? Was I not supposed to? Now, mind you, they were there for academic dishonesty, right? So again, maybe they didn't understand it when I had the conversation with them and they were sitting in my office. So just reiterating that and maybe showing a little grace in the beginning, but the education part is really key. Only because I'm still talking, I'll add one more piece. We have a brand new student code of conduct that was just revised and went into effect yesterday. So it is that new. It has some new language. It has some new, hopefully a better read for students. It's not so legalistic. But we did add one sentence in that is applicable to ChatGPT. I'll just share it with you. So we have a prohibited behavior section that's going to be important for you all to know about. And it says this, engaging in any behavior related to course completion prohibited by the instructor or otherwise included but not limited to unauthorized collaboration and reliance on prohibited technological assistance or artificial intelligence tools. So we as the revisionists or authors of this code thought it was important just to at least add that sentence in so that we also have a little more teeth when we're dealing with academic dishonesty.
Thank you. Thank you. I do like to say, before we get to Bert, I do like the idea of sometimes using these or trying to use these as like a teaching moment kind of thing.
Yeah.
I know there's detectors out there. Zero GPT is pretty good in terms of identifying what's AI generated. And as I was playing around with it over the summer, I wrote up a little something, 250 words, blah, 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 ran through zero GPT, and it came back 16.5% AI generated. Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything in terms of AI generation. Mm-hmm. I probably used a lot of cliche, some jargon, stuff that was not good writing. And if I were in a class and received something like this, I might say, you know what, it's a learning opportunity. Let's iron out your jargon. Mm-hmm. Let's see if you can avoid some cliches in this kind of instance. So there's teachable moments, even if you do say, you know, not at all or a little bit or something of that sort.
If you don't mind, Doug, since you mentioned that, the zero GPT, it is good, right? And it's helpful, but it's not foolproof. And so I also think it's totally okay and reasonable to go to your student and say, hey, did you write this? Or, you know, ask them, are these your own words? Did you use ChatGPT? You know, tell me a little bit about, you know, why this would be flagged if you're using the checker, plagiarism checker in Canvas. What's it called?
Turnitin.
Thank you. Gosh, I can't remember. If you're using Turnitin and it's showing you 100% AI generated, it's okay to ask the student, you know, what did you use? How did you do this? And so starting that conversation, I think, is important.
Politics and Philosophy Department Chair Bert Baumgartner.
There is a distinction I started honing in on between generating text and taking responsibility for text. And I've thought about this in the context of myself as well, because I've often been like, man, I just can't make any headway on this text. So it's like, I wonder what ChatGPT would do with this. I put it in, it's like, oh, it's made a bunch of mistakes, and I go in and correct it. And what ends up coming up with this paragraph is some contributions of it and myself. So the way I'm trying to use this both in the teaching context and in the sort of research context, and I like how Dan was pointing out, like, it won't be your speech. Mm-hmm. What I think is really important is that a student is willing to take responsibility for that essay, even if it wasn't fully generated by themselves. So the way I sort of think about it is, a lawyer in the courtroom can't say, oh, my intern made the mistake when they made that argument, right? even if the lawyer didn't write all of the arguments themselves. So that's the sort of distinction I'm starting to play around with. And when I think about it from that lens, I think of this as, again, like an awesome tool for thinking about shifting work that otherwise would have been part of the sort of generative process and more to the sort of creative responsibility aspect of things. In the same way as I might use, like, hey, Graham Hobbs, here's an argument. I know Graham Hobbs is very skeptical. He's going to tell me why the argument is garbage, right? I go to him as a colleague for him to get ideas, right? And then I reuse those in some kind of way. So that's the kind of hope that I'm, or that's the distinction that I'm hoping will help sort of teach the students, like, this is going to be a really, really great tool. But the generative part is just one small part of it. You're the one who gets the grade at the end. And if your argument isn't very good, you can't be like, well, that's what ChatGPT is like. I don't care where you got it from, right? You need to be willing to take responsibility for the argument.
So, Bert, I have a question. When you started with the ChatGPT and then made some corrections and fixed it and made it better, did you then run it through Zero GPT by chance?
I did not. I haven't played around with Zero.
Okay, so I did something very similar, actually, that bio that we had to come up with. So one of our colleagues sent ChatGPT a query and got this really awesome, kind of funny thing. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. And so I did something similar myself just to see what would come up. And besides the fact that it made me sound like I walked on water, which is clearly not true, I don't know where they were getting their information, I also thought, okay, I'll just do some editing. I did a bunch of editing. So much so that by the time I was done, it was really nothing that had been initially. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to run it through. And it came back as 100% AI generated, even though at that point I had modified basically everything that was there or flat out changed it, like remove sentences, big edits, big, huge edits. So I think what I'm saying is when Andrea says if somebody comes to you and you know you should start by asking them or it's an educational moment, some of us have this tendency to say, yeah, no, we want students to know they can't cheat. So we're sending it in. But the reality is that just like the generator itself is new and changing, the tools to identify what's going on are also changing. I also ran something through that I had written myself and then used Grammarly, which is a kind of a grammar tool. It's also some AI bits in the background. Grammarly gave me no problems, but we don't know if it will tomorrow. So I think that that's something just to always keep in the back of our mind, that the technology, because it's changing, and I still can't figure out how it thought that that thing that I ended up really, it was my work, it still thought it was 100% AI. I'm like, but not.
Turns out you're an AI.
Apparently. Maybe that's it. Okay, anyway.
Well, I do want to get to questions from the audience. Before I do that, two advertisements. One, if you'd like to do or be part of the faculty AI group, if we operate on MS Teams, please let me know, and I will just send you a little email. We'll let you in. All I need is your email address. And the second thing is, kind of to piggyback on what Bert, you're talking about, is this: how can this tool be useful? I'd really like to be able to support anyone here who is interested in how do these AI tools help with learning, ideally help. Maybe it's harmful, I don't know, but we should find out. But if you're interested in putting together some assignments and getting student feedback and things like that on it, I'd be happy to support you out with that, so please see me afterwards. So with that, what questions do you have for us?
Leonard? Yeah, how does a professor catch a student cheating with ChatGPT, considering that these tools are so bad, you know? And considering that from the beginning of the time, students always deny that they have cheated. You know, I've given finals where I see wandering eyes to another paper, and I compare those two papers, they're the same. Oh, we studied together. You know, it's always deniable. So it's a really difficult situation.
Okay.
I think you can. I think generative AI is so powerful now that it generates very much unique texts and responses and things like that. So I think, from my perspective as a philosophy instructor, the days of just get the students to write an essay and submit it are over. It's just going to be too difficult to detect that. So I'm thinking about other ways in which I can get the assessment from that by letting them, for example, write an essay that will have a small component, but then it's the in-class work that ends up being so important. I've always also been tempted by oral exams, but there's other reasons for not doing that, yeah.
I think, too, it depends. Depends is not the right word. I think what you need to do is define for yourself what cheating is. Because for me, cheating might be different from you. You might talk about the assignment together, and that's okay, and I'll accept that. But I know some other people, that's not okay, and that's cheating. So defining what it is, I think, is really important, and communicating that to your students. And then second, I just want to reiterate what you mentioned. It sounds like you're breaking down your assignments into constituent parts. And I think it's a little bit, if that's happening along with some in-class work, that might be some ways to reinforce the idea that it's actually their work that they're doing, even if there is this temptation outside to go to full cloth.
I have also thought that more reflection, right? So this thing that we just learned, how are you going to use it in your real life? All of a sudden the AI is like, well, I don't really have a real life. You know what I mean? So I do a fair amount of that in some of the other classes that I teach, and I haven't seen so many students attempting to use an outside tool for those kind of things, because now I'm asking for their reaction to this thing they learned instead of regurgitating the thing that I wanted them to learn. So I found that to be kind of helpful.
Is it? Help answer your question.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm a perpetual student, but I'm old enough to have watched all the technology
I mean, some of the things go on just blow my mind. It's like Star Trek has on steroids. I just wonder if there's any way to go back in time a little bit to some of those old-fashioned techniques. I'm just going to throw this out. I have a class of maybe, I don't know what you're working with, 30 students these days. So you carve it up into four. And you come up with a selection of four different topics. You've got four groups, four topics. Each one of them has a different question or a topic. So that they're all working with different stuff. So you narrow that potential for, you know what I'm saying? You start to do that. And then you ask everyone to go around in that room and throw out some of their experiences or their ideas having to do with that. And then it comes time to what is the assignment for the day? And the instructor goes, okay, group, whatever your number is, what were you starting with? What was your question? And I want to see three or four examples of what was discussed here. And I think this does two things. I don't think students are looking for original material anymore. I mean, it's and not doing enough of their own research, and it's a little terrifying, actually. But I think, more importantly, this is going to teach them to listen, to really listen to what other people are saying, and then they're able to use their writing skills to record it, which is only going to help their research skills. So I think this emphasis on turning in compositions every semester. I mean, my first degree's in journalism. That's all I did was write. Looking back, I would change the whole curriculum now if AI was a part of that. So I don't know how you would respond to any of those things I just said. If any of that made any sense.
It did. I'm reminded of a report that came out of the 4Cs conference. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. And one of the things that they stressed within their report, it's a 15-page report and pretty easy to read, but what they stressed was there's an increased burden now on instructors and faculty to do the kinds of things that you were suggesting. Mm-hmm. If you already do it in your class of 30, it's not really a problem because you're already doing it. If you're in a class that has 100 plus students and it's set up like this where instructors deliver information, now we have to radically rethink what we're doing, and that's a lot of work sometimes. So, not to discount what you said, I absolutely agree with you, and I think that's one of our big challenges is given the, and I say, you know, sound like a Marxist here, given the economics that we live in academia, it's a huge challenge, and I don't have an answer for that.
So, one of the beautiful things about being trained as a philosopher is, like, this is what we think about and do all the time. I mean, it's like, how do I get my students to, like, do the inquiry part? And so one thing I thought was a weakness of ChatGPT is it's always responding to prompts. I'm always a question asker. I'm always trying to get it to, like, no, that's not quite right. I meant something more like this. And I thought, you know what? It can't do the inquiry part. I flipped it and I asked, like, okay, you're now going to take on the position of an academic. We're going to have a debate about free will. You choose the position that you want to defend, and I'm going to be the person who answers questions. It is amazing how well it does, right? It has access up to 2021, and that debate has, like, thousands of years of history. It has access to all of that. So it can take that role as well. I'm not sure how to sort of respond to that other than students in many cases will find examples, can identify good examples. So I will often at the beginning of the semester say, here's a B paper, or like an A paper, B paper, C paper, D paper, or sorry, here are four papers. Which one is the A, which one is the B, which one is the C, which one is the D, that's right. And they're really, really good identifying what those papers are. They just can't seem to write me the A papers. Those are the ones we're going to see grade. So are the F papers, right? It's the C and B papers that are, like, are time consuming. So my hope is, I don't know how well they might be able to start interacting with ChatGPT to do this, but they might be able to learn from example to see, like, how ChatGPT is doing well or not well at sort of playing the role of the inquirer. That's the place where I think there's still some of the biggest limitations. But yeah, that's one way to sort of think about that process.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Diane. I like your assignment where you're having them actually find the actual article and.
I wanted to first of all point out that if it exists, they can always get it for free from the library. No pain. The interlibrary loan will get it for you. But my experience is that there are lots of hallucinations, lots of citations that do not exist. And in fact, we're working on an exercise in the library to where they have to find that. But that, and that's one of the ways that I started to really identify this kind of, you know, when it's been generated by this. And I think it's really important to then, you know, it's a great skill. Find if this source really exists. Find the actual source. And now we can really say, yeah, you're going to get a lot of imaginary citations. The other thing, somebody mentioned opinions, and I guess I've seen too that it seems like those large language models come back with a statement if you ask for their opinion. I'm a large language model, I do not have opinions. So that was like a real giveaway when I saw that. I was like, oh, I know where this came from. So.
I'll go there, and then next.
I was just going to suggest that we all think about changing our terminology. Calling this ChatGPT, it's a large language model chatbot. There's a breakaway group from OpenAI that created Claude AI. Even better. So there'll be a lot of these. So that was just like a side note. It's not ChatGPT. It's a chatbot. But I just wanted to bring up this thought exercise. So what if we imagine that these chatbots weren't typing to us in written words, but speaking instead? So it's kind of like taking in our Star Trek moment down there. Would anyone have a problem with students talking to a computer that would just talk to them and give them some ideas, and then they would have to go and write it all down? They have to write what they want.
Right.
It would then become an original.
Right.
It would become original writing. But the point is that these things actually spit out text at 1,000 words a minute, and that our final product that we've asking for from students has been 1,000 words of text, so that's 1 minute, it's done, right? So just kind of just thinking about more to the problem here, which is what's the target, what's the assessed product that we're looking for? And if it's bodies of, if it's a wall of text, the generative AI is going to be there for them. Never going to get around that. So we need to start thinking beyond assessing their ability to write a wall of text, because they can't, it's just not going to happen anymore.
I'm going to get to Rula. We have a couple minutes left. Yep. One more question.
The first time Google Assistant, how are you? When Google Assistant asked me, well, I don't know, it just suddenly said, can I listen while you're speaking so I can provide you with better whatever ads, and I thought, hell no. I've been freaked out about that, and I think with the chatbot and all of these things, the problem, similar to the ads that become tailored to your liking, is that all of a sudden your resources, our vision is narrower and narrower and narrower. That's what scares me the most. My question is, and this is not an original question, it's something I heard in a professional meeting I wanted to add, is that the example of a graphic designer working with a particular group, and now that particular group have a generator bot, or an IA generator of forms and so forth, so they longer, and they fed that, the examples that graphic designer have done, so they let them go because they no longer need them. So what are the professional ethics around that, especially in the workplace? And I think those are the kinds of questions, I mean, those are the assumptions, the questions, and the dialogues that we should bring to our students as well. And I started working on them with that because, and I don't hate technology, I am really worried about them overtaking the world.
Agreed. I hope you realize that we have just barely scratched the surface of this topic, and I invite you to come back next week to the continuation of the discussion, where we will be joined by two additional panelists, Dan Carton from Mechanical Engineering,
and Tyler Easterbrook, who is here today. He's the director of composition in the English department, and they'll replace Bert and Diane, but the other three will continue. Before you go, if any of you are new to the Renfrew Colloquium, there is a weekly newsletter that goes out on email Thursday or Friday with the topic for next week. And if you're not receiving that, just send me an email, kbird@uidaho.edu, and I will show you how to add yourself to the list. So, let's thank our organizers.
That last voice was University of Idaho Communications Professor Kenton Bird, who's also the founder of the Renfrew Colloquium, which was held at the University of Idaho on Tuesday. There was a 7-person panel, and the topic was Generative Artificial Intelligence Text Applications and Their Impacts on Academics. The panelists were Writing Center Director Jamaica Richter, Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning Assistant Director of Programming Douglas Habib, Andrea Ingram of the Office of Dean of Students, Psychology and Communications Professor Diane Carter, Politics and Philosophy Department Chair Bert Baumgartner, English Professor and Director of Composition Tyler Easterbrook, and Mechanical Engineering Professor Dan Corden. That was held at the Lionel Hampton School of Music on Tuesday. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow Pullman area. Clear skies tonight, low 52. Tomorrow, sunny, high 89 with widespread haze. Saturday night, widespread haze. Clear during the early evening, then becoming mostly cloudy, low 56. On Sunday, sunny, widespread haze, high 91, and mostly clear. Sunday night and Monday, low 57, high 93. Current temperature is 75. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP.org website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option, and there's a Patreon button as well. Also on the website, you can stream KRFP and listen to the two-week archives of any shows broadcast in the last 2 weeks. I'm Lee Robartis. Kurt Morrison, Brenda Cox, and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.